This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. We are less than a month to the election, and this week was total chaos. The president spent a few days at the hospital to get treatment for COVID, but now he says he's better and he's back at the White House. He's even been in the Oval Office. He's been on the phone with Fox News, sounding pretty energetic and well with Maria Bartiromo on Thursday morning, and a little more languid and congested with Sean Hannity on Thursday evening. His doctors say he can resume live events by Saturday, and he says he'd like to have next Thursday's town hall debate in person as scheduled in Miami. But the White House has not produced a negative COVID test for the president as we tape on Friday morning, nor will they say when he last tested negative before he tested positive on Thursday last week. Was he tested before he went to Cleveland with his unmasked supporters for last Tuesday's debate? We don't know, and the White House won't say, and so far the Commission on Presidential Debates says they're sticking with their insistence that the next debate, if it happens, must be remote. The president has also repeatedly sought to resume and then blow up talks about a COVID relief bill, with Republicans in the Senate signaling clearly that they would prefer to spend the next few weeks confirming Amy Coney Barrett at the Supreme Court rather than passing another large spending bill. To talk about all that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review on the right, and on the left, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. Hello.
Hey there.
Hi, Josh.
Let's start with where this chaos began, which is the emergence of a White House COVID cluster and the development of that cluster. And to discuss that, we're joined by our special guest, Christy Ashwanden. Christy is a science journalist and contributor to Wired, Scientific American, and The Washington Post. Hello, Christy.
Hi.
So, Christy, what do we know and what can we infer about how COVID spread among the people around the president?
Yeah, well, what's really clear at this point is that we had some sort of super spreader event here. What we're seeing now is a large number of people, as many as perhaps 35, the last count that I saw, who've been in contact with the president who have now tested positive. And one of the things that we know about COVID is that a small proportion of people who have it are responsible for an outward number of the spread. And it looks like it's something like 10 to 20% of those people with the virus are responsible for something like 80% of the spread via these super spreader events.
So, Michael, this COVID cluster, I mean, these super spreader events, they're not pure luck. There are actions that we take to try to prevent them. For example, we don't have celebrations indoors without masks with substantial crowds as the White House did. The White House has also been supposed to be taking specific precautions having to do with testing people who come on site there. But the White House isn't saying, you know, whether and when they've actually been testing the president for COVID. They won't say when his last negative test was. So isn't this something that voters should look at and say that this is a reason not to reelect the president? That if he can't even keep COVID out of the White House, how is he supposed to protect the rest of us?
I think it's perfectly legitimate to judge the president not just on the broad political response to COVID, which has been ruining his chance for reelection all year, but also to judge that larger response by the White House's own practices. I mean, I think I saw the former head of the FDA, Scott Gottlieb, criticizing the White House for trying to protect itself only with a testing regime, but not with adequate social distancing practices or masks, and, you know, basically laying out the case that this was bound to fail at some point, given how much activity was going on in the White House. I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to take. I mean, if character is destiny, you know, we may be seeing something of the character of the Trump administration in this failure. I mean, he's not the only government official to contract COVID. Prime Minister Boris Johnson and others have done so as well, but he's the only one of a modern, rich Western nation who has been downplaying the risks and also caught COVID. So it's absolutely fair to judge him.
Yeah. So what we know about super spreader events is that these are mostly driven by environmental factors. It's not something special about the person who's doing the super spreading. It's really the environment. And what we know is that large crowd sizes, close contact, confined spaces, poor ventilation, there's also a time component here. The more time you spend in these confined spaces, the greater the chance of spread. And what we've seen here at the White House is multiple events with Trump where he is engaging in these situations and these events that meet a lot of these criteria. And so basically setting things up, it was almost inevitable that this would happen.
Jamel, the funny thing for me for talking about this as a character issue is that this isn't just about the president putting his needs ahead of other people. Now, obviously, there's an element of that where he thinks that talk about COVID and outward signs that COVID is a problem are bad for his political chances. And I think that's a reason that he's resisted masks at the White House. But the president has incurred significant costs of his own here. I mean, first of all, he got COVID. It sounds like he was quite sick, at least at the beginning of this. Maybe he's gotten significantly better over the last week. And also, this has been terrible for him politically. It has shifted the focus of the election back indelibly onto this issue that is terrible for him. It makes him look reckless and stupid. And so it seems to me like this goes beyond even the president being self-interested, because this is one of many times where it would have been in the president's self-interest to handle this better, and yet he didn't.
I think that's right. And we've talked about this before, I believe, but I think it just gets to his, inability to act in his political self-interest when it cuts across his own sort of perception or belief about either his own ego, his own sort of psychological self-preservation, right? He has constructed for himself a persona in which he, cannot be wrong and cannot show weakness. And doing the politically smart thing here might threaten that that construction. And he exists in this symbiotic relationship with certain vocal parts of his base, in that he is taking his cues from them and they're taking their cues from him. And so in this case, his early mask skepticism helps encourage kind of an anti-mask movement among his strongest supporters. And in turn, he is reluctant to want to, go back on that early anti-mask sentiment, because it may alienate him with the supporters whom he encouraged in the first place. And so he himself created a situation for himself where he cannot do what is politically advantageous for him to do. And I think this is very much the story of his administration in terms of the politics of his administration. It really is striking that he is doing so poorly. This wasn't, and I argued this earlier this week in my column, this wasn't a given. Andrew Cuomo of New York had a very rocky start in handling the pandemic. Arguably, a significant part of New York's deaths are a product of choices he took at the beginning of the pandemic. And yet, he is quite popular with New Yorkers. And I think that it's because voters recognize that this is an extraordinary situation and are willing to let political leaders make mistakes as long as they believe that those leaders are trying to account for those mistakes. And once they come to believe that the leaders are no longer trying to do that, no longer trying to address the situation with the seriousness it deserves, that's when they turn. And that's what I think Trump has suffered from.
Michael, do you agree with that characterization that the president is sort of trapped between his base and the public here? Because there was a Fox News poll this week that found over 70% support for a national mandate to wear masks. And so for a number to get that high, there has to be not just near unanimous support among Democrats, but very substantial support among Republicans. And I don't mean to focus that on that specific issue of a mask mandate, which has certain constitutional issues if you tried to impose it federally. But the support for a really robust COVID response that prioritizes public safety over reopening the economy is strong and has lots of partisans even on the Republican side. So it feels to me like this was even politically stupider, that this was really a top-down thing where certain Republicans decided they were going to be the party that was against taking measures against COVID, and that was foreseeably going to make them unpopular, and that they didn't have to do that to satisfy their own voters.
I think it's pretty complex set of factors, especially when you look at the international scene. What you see is that there are leaders who, like Trump, portrayed themselves as nationalist populists on the right, who took a much harder line at the beginning. They're very attuned to foreign threats, very concerned about their borders. They shut down very quickly and got out of the first wave much faster. And some of them, tried to speak to the public in the same way that Andrew Cuomo did in New York. I mean, Sebastian Kurz of Austria mandated masks very early and admitted that you know, this would be difficult to do. And the public was with them for a time. Trump could have done that, I think, and made the Republican Party more hawkish generally in its response. But still, lots of the opposition internationally to some of the longer lockdowns and other methods that have been used to mitigate the pandemic have come from a populist right that is skeptical of the expert class generally. That's why you see even this week in the UK, some of the more conservative newspapers are attacking the conservative government's strict policies on COVID-19. So I do think that while Trump could have benefited politically from being stricter, I do think there is a kind of time limit on these measures, and popular opposition to them does gather over time. And I think we're seeing that worldwide.
I want to talk some about the president's treatment, because he's made sort of conflicting statements over the last week, some about how these amazing drugs that he was put on basically cured him and he thinks he's better now, and also statements about how he doesn't think he really needed this treatment and that he would have gotten better anyway. Christy, what do we know about the seriousness of the president's initial condition and the effectiveness of the drugs that he was put on? We know that he's been on the antiviral drug remdesivir, he's been on the steroid dexamethasone, and he's been on these, he received these experimental antibody cocktails. Do we know how sick he was and what role these drugs played in whatever improvement he has made since about a week ago?
Well, it's quite remarkable, actually, how very little we know about the president's condition and about his diagnosis. We don't even know, you know, the extent to which he was being tested prior to his positive test last Thursday. We don't know the time course and all of that. He says that he's doing great. His doctors are going on television and saying that he's doing quite well. But then when the cameras go off, he tells reporters something else. I think the lack of accurate information here is really stunning. But these drugs that he's on are almost all experimental. They're unproven at this point. You know, I think the thing to keep in mind here is that this is an entirely new virus. We've only known about this thing for like 10 months. So we're really, you know, this is really a work in progress in terms of what we know about how to treat it. But some of these drugs that he's on really imply that his case is much more serious than he's saying. These are not drugs that you give to someone who has a mild case of this disease. And so if you look at what's being said, it appears as though, you know, this is no big deal. But if you look at what's being done to treat him and you look at these drugs that he's on, it really does imply that this is not just a minor case and that this is something he could be quite sick with. Another important thing to keep in mind is that this disease and this illness has a time course. And we're actually, you know, these first few days are not the most crucial, actually. I think the next week and even this weekend could be very important here in terms of how sick he gets. What we see with this virus is that very often people start to feel a little bit better. And then there's a secondary response. And that's where things get really serious. So by no means is he out of the woods yet.
It's been interesting to me politically how much the White House messaging has leaned into the effectiveness of these drugs that the president's been put on. You saw Mike Pence talking about some of these drugs on Wednesday at the vice presidential debate. And part of the reason for the focus on these therapeutic drugs is that, you know, some of them are becoming increasingly available now at a time when we do not have a vaccine. And the White House has admitted that they're not going to have a vaccine approved before the election. This had been a big fight between regulators at the FDA, who were trying to change some regulations that would have made it even more difficult to approve the vaccine that quickly. And Michael, one thing that we've talked about on this show in the last few weeks is who's responsible for deciding that a vaccine is safe and who the public ought to be listening to. And you've been saying, you know, you don't have to trust the president here. There's a whole bureaucracy that does this. And so it's sort of a category error to talk about, do you trust the president about the vaccine? Do you feel proved right by what's happened this week, where basically, you know, even though they won that bureaucratic fight over the regulation, it's the FDA is still not going to move on this before the election. So to the extent the president was trying to get a specific regulatory outcome there, he wasn't actually able to get it.
Yes, I do feel a little bit vindicated. None of the companies that are working on these vaccines want to be seen publicly to have benefited from some kind of thumb on the scale, especially if that thumb was President Trump's. Many of them are public companies. They are subject not just to international markets, but they're also in many cases running simultaneous trials in other countries that are being subjected to independent boards that the president would have no influence over. And I also think that for some months now, it's even though the president has denied this, it's been clear that even if a vaccine is approved, even if it was approved in September, or if it's approved in a few weeks in October, which seems extremely unlikely now, there's no mechanism for distributing something like this quickly in order to benefit him politically for this election. And that's become, I think that was obvious 2 months ago, and now it's beyond a shadow of a doubt. So again, I think it's important. I think it's very important. And when polls show so much public distrust among Republicans and Democrats for the forthcoming vaccines, wherever they may come from, I think it's actually important for public officials to bolster the public's trust in them and in the process, precisely because we may not fully escape this crisis until we have a significant number of people take a semi-effective or very effective vaccine.
Jamel, what did you make of the exchange about that at the debate where Mike Pence was really hitting Kamala Harris, saying that she'd been irresponsible here for sowing doubt? Harris's line was, you know, I trust the scientists, I trust Dr. Fauci, but I don't trust Donald Trump. And so she's not saying don't take the vaccine, but again, I guess, you know, it feels to me like, you know, do you trust Donald Trump really the relevant question here? And is focusing on that going to make it more difficult to get the buy-in that we need, where we need as much of the public as possible to take this vaccine once it is known to be safe and effective and is approved?
The public largely shares Harris's view that they don't necessarily have much faith that Donald Trump is going to be honest about the vaccine, but they do have faith in the science behind the vaccine. And to the extent that taking the vaccine is not seen as somehow validating Trump, which I don't think it will be, I don't think there's much to worry about. In that view, people want their lives to return to normal. They want things to be as they were. And if a vaccine is part of the path to that, I think people will be ready to take it. But I personally do not see a problem. Knowing just how much Donald Trump is prepared to bend, you know, every element of the United States government to his interest, I just don't think it's unreasonable for someone to say, yeah, you know, I trust what the scientists say about the vaccine. I understand everything that's going to go into producing a vaccine, but I'm not really, you know, if Donald Trump tells me to take something, I'm not sure I'm not sure gonna give that a lot of credence. I think that's a totally reasonable position to have, given everything.
Of course, I mean, when we look at problematic public health statements about the coronavirus this week, I think the number one offender still has to be the president, who, you know, came out of this and was basically claiming that he was cured, maybe he's immune. We still don't have a negative coronavirus test for him after this episode. It's too early in the course for him to say that he is cured of the coronavirus, and then also telling people, don't let it run your life, don't fear it too much. And so, Christy, I'm wondering what you make of that at a time when, in certain parts of the country, especially the Midwest, we're seeing a significant uptick in coronavirus cases, and the weather's getting colder, and it's harder to keep people from gathering indoors.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would just say that the rejection of science on display here is just totally unprecedented. I mean, here you have a president who is completely disregarding, you know, the best advice from his own medical experts, from the nation's top public health officials. He's completely flouting, you know, these rules that have been put in place or this guidance. And so, you know, I think that it's hard to trust the guy if he's not even, you know, on the one hand, you have Anthony Fauci saying one thing and then Trump gets up and does something else, says something else. You know, he's been holding these large events, crowded events in confined spaces. Those are all things that are, you know, not really supposed to be happening right now. And so it makes it very difficult to trust what's going on. And I think he's actually done a pretty good job of undermining trust in some of these things, because it's hard to know who's making the decisions. We've had numerous officials speaking out against what's going on there. We've had people who have resigned sort of in protest. Rick Bright, an immunologist who was director of the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, recently wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post explaining that he had quit quit that job in protest. And so, you know, it's a problem here. And I don't think that we've ever seen this level of meddling with science at this level of government before.
Let's take a break. I'll be back with Michael Brendan Doherty of National Review, Jamel Bowie of the New York Times, and Christy Ashwanden, author and contributor to Wired, Scientific American, and The Washington Post, to talk about the vice presidential debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Michael Brendan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times. And our special guest is Christy Ashwanden, author and contributor to Wired, Scientific American, and The Washington Post. Wednesday's vice presidential debate began with a discussion of the Trump administration record on coronavirus. Moderator Susan Page pointed out that the per capita death rate from COVID is about 2.5 times higher in the U.S. than in Canada. Why, she asked the vice president, have we done so much worse than other rich countries? Pence's answer was essentially that if we'd done less, we could have had even more deaths. We could have had a couple of million deaths, and that the president's partial shutdown of travel from China and his moves in concert with governors to shut down much of the economy in mid-March were early actions that prevented this situation from being even worse than it was. Michael, do you think that's a fair assessment? And if you do, how does it square with other comments that the president made along the way, that the coronavirus would magically disappear, that it's like the flu, that people were too worried about it?
I mean, to answer the last part of the question, it doesn't square with what the president has been saying all along. I mean, the president has been saying a variety of things that turned out to be obviously wrong. I remember very early on, he talked about how we had, you know, 15 cases and it could go down to zero shortly. And I thought that was obviously not credible at the time. I do think that the travel restriction strategy that the president tried with China was the correct thing to try, and it was criticized by public health authorities, including the World Health Organization at the time. We've now since had a report in the New York Times that the World Health Organization's reasoning for this recommendation against travel restrictions was entirely political and not at all based in science. However, I criticized at the time that the travel restriction on China was not thorough enough. It was not accompanied by any testing regime for those who could come through the net that essentially was put up. And we know now that there was enough seeding from Europe on the East Coast by this time that it was already becoming too late, and the amount of spread was getting out of control in the United States in February. So I do think the president can take a tiny amount of credit for the imperfect travel restriction he placed on China in the face of public health authorities who were not speaking with public health reasoning against it. But overall, the United States' response has not been very good. I mean, it may be in 5 years that we will look back and discover that very few countries responded as they in an ideal way. Europe is not out of the woods either on this yet. But right now, you have to judge the United States pretty poorly.
Christy, as Michael notes, Europe is facing a really terrible second wave right now, and case rates per capita are once again higher in the United Kingdom and France and the Netherlands and various other countries than they are here in the U.S. So how do you assess our performance relative to other countries? Have we done consistently worse, or is it just that this thing goes in waves and that a lot of countries have made a lot of mistakes along the way?
Oh, it's certainly true that a lot of countries have made mistakes along the way. I mean, to reiterate my earlier point, this is a new virus. You know, we're learning as we go here. But I think it's fair to say that the U.S. response has been extraordinarily bad. At this point, it's very, very clear that the most powerful tools that we have for controlling this virus are things like behavior, you know, masking, social distancing, limiting group sizes, things like this. But then the other piece here that that's really important is testing, and not just testing. It's important that we have a good testing regime, but testing is only the first part. What you need to do is when you have positive tests, you need to be able to isolate those people to stop those chains of transmission. And that requires a lot of things. It requires, you know, these social supports for those people to be able to, say, take 2 weeks off of work. There are a lot of people right now, particularly vulnerable people in our society, who don't have the means to do this. But we've also just done a terrible job in the U.S. for the most part. This isn't universally true. There are some places that have gotten it right. But contact tracing has really not been a strength here in the U.S. This is how you stop these chains of transmission. You find people who are positive. You isolate them. You find the people that they've been in contact with who they may have spread the virus to, and you isolate them as well. And if you do that, particularly in the early stages when it's, you know, the pandemic or the epidemic is not out of control and you don't have an inordinate number of cases, you really can stop transmission and you can slow things down. But once you get behind on this and you start having lots and lots of cases, it's very hard to keep up. And that's essentially what's happened in a lot of parts of the U.S.
Jamil, do we have clarity on what would be different next year in a Biden administration in terms of containing the and addressing the coronavirus compared to another year of the Trump administration?
I think to the extent that there would be a difference, because this came up during the vice presidential debate, that Harris went through the litany of things that Biden has proposed, and Mike Pence, not incorrectly, said that those are similar to the recommendations of the coronavirus task force. I think the difference is that a Biden administration would be much more serious about hewing to the recommendations of the coronavirus task force, that you wouldn't have kind of the principal political figure undermining the message coming out of the government. And that does make a big difference. It makes a difference to have a kind of unified and united federal government sending the same message and encouraging states and localities to follow the rules set out. So even if the recommendations don't change at all, even if it's sort of the exact same outline program for handling the pandemic, follow through matters a great deal. Follow through may be the entire game. And I think the difference would be that there would be real follow through in a Biden administration.
One thing I've noticed is other countries that have taken pretty strict lockdown measures to control the virus, including the UK and Israel, have started receiving more and more criticism from scientists. There's this great Barrington statement that was signed criticizing the Johnson government for ignoring the public health effects of lockdown policies on people's mental health and physical health. And I'm curious if there is more discord in the scientific community and that under a Biden administration, we might see more of that.
Yeah. So the Great Barrington Declaration was led by a small group of scientists, really arguing that we need to stop lockdowns and open things up and basically let everyone return to normal except the most vulnerable people in the population. The problem is that they're sort of taking down a straw man. I don't think that there's really anyone right now in the public health community who's saying that we need to be, you know, engaged in very strict lockdowns universally. You know, that may be something that's used in particular areas when you have a local outbreak. But the other thing here is that it's very, very difficult to protect those vulnerable people. The idea that they're just living themselves in separate places. Our vulnerable population is integrated with the rest of the population. We really need to continue engaging in these behaviors. And it doesn't mean that we have to be locked down. I live in Colorado. We are certainly not in any sort of lockdown right now. I can go to businesses. I can go to stores. The schools are open. There are certainly new rules in place, but I don't think it would be correct to say that we're all just staying at home and locked down. And so, you know, I think for the next year or however long it takes until we have a widespread vaccine that's been deployed, we're going to have to continue figuring out how to live within these behaviors and these strategies that we know can limit the spread of this. And one of the nice things about this super spreading being such a factor in the spread of COVID is that super spreader events are things that we can control and we can prevent. You know, it may not be pleasant. It means that you can't go to those big concerts. There are certain things that you can't do. But if we can continue to, you know, limit large events, if we can continue to do some social distancing, there's really a lot that we can do just with these things to control the spread.
In that spirit, should this vice presidential debate have happened in person? Mike Pence is a member of the president's inner circle. He's repeatedly tested negative, but he's not been isolating himself. Joe Biden was exposed to the president on Tuesday of last week. The president spent 90 minutes basically yelling at Joe Biden from about 12 feet away. Joe Biden has also been repeatedly testing negative for the coronavirus, but he's been out on the campaign trail. It seems like, you know, this, and we see this also in the Senate, where Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, is refusing a challenge from his opponent to take a coronavirus test. It kind of looks like Republicans in the Senate don't want to know about any more COVID cases, lest that interfere with the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett. So it feels to me like we are seeing, principally among Republicans, but also to some extent among Democrats, behavior being modeled at the top here that's not consistent with this idea of taking targeted interventions to stop the spread of COVID, so we don't need broader ones.
Yeah, I mean, from a scientific perspective, this is absolutely reckless behavior. And it's being, you know, modeled, like you say, from the very top levels of government, and that's problematic.
Let's leave that there. Christy Ashwanden is a science journalist and a contributor to Wired, Scientific American, and The Washington Post. She's the author of the book Good to Go: What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christy, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I've been talking with Jamelle Bouie of The New York Times and Michael Brennan Doherty of National Review. We will be back to talk about the on-again, off-again talks about another COVID economic relief package. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Michael Brennan Doherty, senior writer at National Review. On the left is Jamelle Bouie, columnist at The New York Times. Last Saturday, while the president was hospitalized at Walter Reed, he tweeted, quote, "Our great USA wants and needs stimulus. Work together and get it done. Thank you," unquote. This was yet another step in the on-again, off-again talks about doing another economic relief package to address the disruption to the economy and to individual households and businesses from COVID. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin has had a number of lengthy phone calls with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, no longer having in-person meetings because of all of this COVID spread. And he significantly increased the White House's bid to a $1.6 trillion package, which would have included $250 billion for states and localities. Pelosi and Democrats still wanted a larger package. Their number lately has been $2.2 trillion, but perhaps more importantly, Republicans in the Senate want less. And after a phone call where Senate Leader Mitch McConnell impressed on the president the limited time available in the Senate to confirm Amy Coney Barrett at the Supreme Court and the limited appetite for a big stimulus among Senate Republicans, Trump called off the talks in another tweet on Tuesday, saying Democrats were demanding too much money for cities run by Democrats. Then he started almost immediately tweeting calls for piecemeal stimulus legislation, such as another round of $1,200 checks. And then there were news reports that he was again interested in a big stimulus deal. And then on Friday, around noontime Eastern, he tweeted, "Go big on stimulus." So, Michael, is there any sincere effort here from the president to get a deal done? Or does he just want the stock market to think he might get a deal done? Because the market seems to go up whenever there's talk of a deal. The market has not moved to a position of just ignoring whatever the president says about this. And when the president said on Tuesday that he was killing the talks, the Dow Jones fell 600 points very quickly. So it's clear that if the president cares about the stock market as a barometer of the economy, he'd want people to think these talks are ongoing, even if there's never going to be a deal.
Right. And it's also very probable that after his Tuesday tweet calling off the talks, that the White House fielded several extremely urgent and angry phone calls from the airline industry or other large interests before Trump started tweeting about reopening talks again. I think the president's been pretty desultory on this. But at the same time, I think the politics were cutting a little bit against Nancy Pelosi's position, where I think there was some pressure on moderate Democrats that wanted to get some kind of relief to their constituents and fear facing election when perhaps one of their only accomplishments is impeaching the president, who was not removed. So I think there was developing pressure on Nancy Pelosi, and then Trump took it all away by, in effect, on Tuesday, taking responsibility for the breakdown of talks on himself entirely. I think it makes it much easier for Nancy Pelosi to say that they're negotiating with a madman and can't get a deal done with him. I still think it would be very good for the country, for tons of small businesses, and for probably millions of households if a deal can be done before the election. But the political logic of that is getting more difficult for everyone. If Steve Mnuchin and Nancy Pelosi could work out a deal, though, in the next few days, I do think all the pressure would fall on Mitch McConnell and the Republican Senate, and the president would be putting him in a very difficult position, and probably an untenable one.
Jamel, should Pelosi have taken this $1.6 trillion offer? Because I look at, we've been having these conversations for months, and the economic picture has changed in a number of ways over that period. And some of the picture has gotten worse. There are certain industries like travel and hospitality that I think are going to take even longer to come back than we may have expected back in the spring. But there are other parts that have looked better. Household income is actually going to be significantly higher this year than it was last year, even if there isn't another round of stimulus because of all the payments that were made in the prior rounds of stimulus. State and local governments haven't done as badly in terms of their revenue picture as you might have expected, in part because most of the decline in the economy is in services. The sales tax mostly applies to goods, so the sales tax revenues and the property tax revenues on homes that haven't seemed to decline in value, a lot of that stuff seems to be sort of okay. It feels to me like this loaf was big enough that there's a strong argument that Democrats should have just taken it. And then if they win this election, they can go and they can do another round of stimulus afterward anyway.
That's where I am, pretty much, that there is good reason to pass additional stimulus right now. $1.6 trillion, although it does not contain everything the Democrats or Pelosi specifically wanted, is still pretty good. And there's still space for further stimulus should Democrats win in November and win a trifecta at that, at the Senate, the White House, and continue to hold the House. So I think Pelosi should have taken the deal. I think Pelosi should take whatever deal comes up. Of course, now that Trump has basically signaled that he's desperate for something, she has more leverage. But I don't think she has so much leverage that she could force McConnell to take anything. And so my hunch is that anything that comes out of this will be similar to the $1.6 trillion, maybe with an extra $100 or $200 billion tacked on. And I think that's what Democrats should take. That's what Pelosi should take. The people still need assistance. People still need aid. The economy still needs something to hold it through the winter, especially if things get worse in terms of the health picture. So, do it now. And, frankly, just in terms of cynical politics, I think we're past the point where this could assist or help Trump rebound in the polls. Just empirically, it's sort of the second and third quarter economy, which matters most for an incumbent president. And then the public will have witnessed, months of Trump refusing to act. They will have witnessed this current kind of desperation. And people are already voting at that. So I don't think it even matters politically anymore. It purely is, do you want to get help to people in this moment? And I think that we should.
Michael, if Pelosi got to yes with Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, would that cause the relief package to happen? While there's clearly resistance among Senate Republicans, it's been clear throughout this administration that Republicans in Congress find it extremely difficult to get politically crosswise with the president. He was able to push through the CARES Act back in March, which had a lot of provisions that a lot of conservatives were very uncomfortable with. On the other hand, we're so close to the election. There are actual constraints on the use of time on the Senate floor, and they have this very high stakes judicial nomination to move. So I'm wondering if this is the case where even if Trump wanted this, could he push it through the chamber of the Congress that his party controls?
I think he could. It may be close run on time, but the political pressure on Republican senators would be absolutely astonishing, I think. You would absolutely have holdouts like I would expect that Cruz and a few other green eyeshade wearing Republican senators would oppose the bill, but I don't think you'd have trouble getting it through. It does matter. It's not an unpopular vote. So I think once it comes to them, they'll pass it.
I want to take a look forward a little bit to a couple of different ways that this election could work out and what that's going to mean for this relief policy as we go into 2021. I mean, Jamel, let's talk first about, we said if they pass this stimulus bill, if they win, they could pass another one later. What does an economic agenda look like for Democrats coming in 2021? Because there's going to be a lot of competing priorities, some of them about, you know, healthcare, and there are all these procedural questions about the Supreme Court, and should we admit Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. as a state, and all of these other things. So if they're prioritizing, you can sort of look at the first few months of the Obama administration, the way they were consumed by the fight over the Stimulus Act in 2009. So how do Democrats take their first 100 days, assuming that they win everything, and figure out how to, as efficiently as possible, achieve as many of these goals as they can?
Well, much of Biden's kind of big agenda items, at least the things he's been talking about most on the stump, the Build Back Better, imagine quotes over when I said that, infrastructure stuff, public option for the Affordable Care Act, and kind of just shoring up the Affordable Care Act as a law, sort of immediate assistance to families. All that stuff can be, I mean, the House and the Senate, House and Senate Democrats can start get to work on that kind of legislation right now and have it ready for day one or day two to pass. And my understanding is that quite a few of these things can be passed under reconciliation rules, meaning that Democrats can bypass a likely filibuster and pass things on sort of a 51 person vote in the Senate, and then obviously a majority vote in the House. And so if I were recommending something, it would be to take basically the low hanging fruit of the Biden platform, wrap it up into a singular package, and just pass it first things first. It's the procedural and structural stuff around, creating a new state or new states, the voting rights stuff, Supreme Court stuff, that is going to be obviously more contentious, both within the Democratic caucus and obviously in the public at large. And I don't necessarily think that that is the stuff that needs to be addressed first and foremost, especially when the low-hanging fruit is relatively easy to just get done. You can roll out this stuff pretty quickly, all things considered. And I should add, because there's actual consensus for it among Democrats, right? So for comparison's sake, it's worth looking back to 2009 in the fight over the Affordable Care Act, and specifically the battle to get a public option into the Senate bill. The House bill had a public option. The Senate bill did not. And a big part of that reason was that red state Democrats like Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas and Evan Bayh of Indiana had voiced their opposition and said they would not support a bill with a public option. You look today at Senate Democrats that may be elected from red states, like Jamie Harrison in South Carolina, who is running a very close race with Lindsey Graham. Arizona is sort of a purple state, but Mark Kelly in Arizona, the current senator from Arizona, Democrat Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin in West Virginia, they all support a public option. The party has moved to the left enough so that is a consensus position. And so when you start to look at where the consensus positions are, and they more or less line up with most of Biden's platform, I don't think there's going to be a big political battle over trying to turn those into law. And that's why it becomes a relatively straightforward thing politically just to roll those out as soon as possible.
And then, Michael, what happens if Biden wins this election, but Republicans manage to hold on to their Senate majority? And so you have to have governance between Nancy Pelosi and presumably Mitch McConnell and Joe Biden. What do you expect to see Republicans in the Senate do as we enter into a year where this coronavirus crisis still is not resolved, although we will likely have an approved vaccine by then, and where we will have an enormous budget deficit?
I think you're going to see the Republican Party readopt in a way that makes progressives crazy. Republicans will readopt their budget hawkishness. And I think, you know, we'll return to a time when, you know, Barack Obama got extremely frustrated with the Republican Senate. Even when he could get deals done with John Boehner in the House, the Senate could stymie him. And, you know, I just think you'll immediately see Democrats kind of go further in on their view of reforming the Senate or the Supreme Court and taking constitutional measures in hand. I think you'll also see a lot of rhetoric about Joe Biden having a pen and a phone and trying, as sometimes President Trump has done, trying to govern through executive order and being creative through the executive branch.
Jamal, do you see any of the innovations that Trump has had there as being something that, that Democrats might draw on? I know Elizabeth Warren, when she was running for president, was talking about finding creative ways to use executive orders. Obviously, the president's record on that in terms of effectiveness of the orders has been mixed. Often what he wants is something that he can wave around on television and say that he issued an order. I think Democrats, for good reason, worry about the prospect of not being able to get much policymaking done if they don't take the whole Congress back.
I have to imagine that if we do get a Democratic House, Democratic White House, and Republican Senate, President Biden is going to attempt to accomplish what he can through agencies, through executive orders. I would see that, aside from just kind of I have my substantive preferences and I'd like to see those actually passed in the law. I would just see that as the worst possible outcome. I think that there needs to be, for sort of the health of not even democracy, but for the health of policymaking, there needs to be – energy needs to shift back to Congress. Congress needs to actually do things. And a Biden administration reliant on executive orders would represent an entrenchment of trends that I think are actually quite damaging to American government, to policymaking. So although I think it'd be likely in that situation, I'd be very, very unhappy about it. And my preference – is for unified government, largely because I just want to see Congress doing more. And, you know, for as much as I have written in favor of various structural reforms to American government, I also think that the single biggest thing that could fix many of the problems facing American government is just a more active and more energetic Congress.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Michael Brendan Doherty, what's your rant?
As a hobby, I like to fool around with foreign languages, learn a little bit, try to meet with people online to learn to speak, at least at a very rudimentary level. And I've noticed that Americans and English speakers around the world who have English as their mother tongue are always beating themselves up about their inability to learn foreign languages, that the schools have failed them. And I just want to tell everyone, it is not your fault. It is not your fault that you have failed to learn a second language. It is because you were given the privilege of English as a mother tongue, and it's the lingua franca. A billion other people on Earth are trying to learn English as a second language. That's why when you go to France and you speak poor French, they immediately respond to you in English because they want to practice a more economically advantageous language. It's not your fault. Stop beating yourself up. Just have fun with it.
Can I add quickly to Michael? If you find yourself bad at languages, you can also take my approach, which is to learn Latin so you don't have to speak it. My rant has to do with, I suppose, uses and abuses of early American history. I'm very much very interested in and a bit of an enthusiast of history of the early American Republic, roughly 1760s to the 1820s. And one thing that I have taken away from reading about and studying the period is that it's a very dangerous game to try to transpose our political debates and ideologies and such onto that period. That Americans then, for as similar as they may have been to us, were also dealing with very different issues, in some ways much more fundamental issues of democracy, of constitutionalism, of popular government than we are. And that as much as possible, we should read the past without trying to bring our own baggage onto it and reading the past in trying to imagine oneself as not knowing what's going to come next, because the people at the time did not know what was going to come next. And so as I, you know, read contemporary political writing and debates that draw on the past, I would just recommend to people to remember that you really do have to take the past on its own terms.
For my rant, the FBI announced arrests of six men who engaged in a conspiracy plot to kidnap Michigan's Democratic Governor Gretchen Whitmer. The conspirators were outraged over tight coronavirus restrictions in the state, restrictions over which the president has also sought to foment outrage, tweeting at one point, "Liberate Michigan." In Michigan, it's perfectly legal to bring your assault rifle into the state capitol building, and activists did so in substantial numbers this spring, freaking out state legislators, but not leading to a change in that policy. Republicans have sometimes appreciated the political energy that fringe groups like this have created as they fight with Democrats who have imposed these restrictions. But both the positions and the tactics of these extreme groups are unpopular, and if you encourage them, sooner or later they may kill somebody. I'm glad the FBI caught this plot, but I'd like to see a little more introspection from Republicans about whom they've encouraged and how, starting with the president. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank our special guest, Christy Ashwanden, and our panelists, Jamel Bowie and Michael Brendan Doherty. Michael and Jamel are completing their run on the right and the left. I want to thank them both for these great conversations we've had over the last few weeks, and I look forward to having them back on the show next year. Thank you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Josh.
Next week, and through the presidential election, I will be joined by a new panel with Tim Carney of the Washington Examiner on the right and Christine Emba from the Washington Post on the left. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Our production fellow is Victoria Alejandro. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.
Support for Left, Right, and Center comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/LRC. That's odoo.com/LRC. Odoo, modern management made simple.